Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations. This is episode 13 on a 1959 work by Donald Roy entitled Banana Time, Job Satisfaction and Informal Interaction. To find the text and for more information, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This episode is brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. My name is Dimitris, coming to you from Birmingham in the United Kingdom.
My name is Miranda, coming to you from Leamington Spa in the United Kingdom.
This is Pedro, coming to you from Brooklyn, New York City.
This is Ralph, coming to you from the doorstep of Manchester Metropolitan University in Manchester, England.
Oh.
Yes, there's three of us in the UK now, and now you're the only one.
We changed places.
Yes, you're the odd man out.
Yes.
Exactly.
Shifting around.
It's a mobile podcast.
It actually very much is, yes. We're covering most of the Western Hemisphere consistently. All right, so Banana Time. How about a title like that?
Makes me hungry already.
It's great.
Yes, it was. it was very surprising. Not the hunger part, but just the title.
I guess we should give a brief introduction to the paper and what it's about before we go on to talk
Sound
about
great.
It.
So I'll give a start. It's a report of research that was done by David Roy in a manufacturing environment or context to understand social relations between the workers and motivation. And he actually functioned as a machine operator in this organization as he was collecting his research. And he found some surprising insights about how the drudgery or monotony of repetitive work can still not be an obstacle to staying motivated at your job.
Right, exactly. So he was working at what sounded like one of the most monotonous and repetitive types of organized labor that, you know, one could imagine, basically punching holes in different types of materials to specifications. And I'm not sure if he was doing research. I think he was actually working there prior to his academic career, but of course, that's not that important. But what he discovered was that even in situations such as these, people found ways to avoid this grudging boredom by playing games and structuring their work in these different ways that he's describing along the themes of time and, well, themes. They would play jokes on each other and so on and so forth. And that had implications for the labor process in many different ways that we'll cover.
Yeah, I just want to add to what you just said is that I think the interesting thing is that, you know, we expect fun and interactions and all kind of, you know, games also to happen at work. And it's not only that, you know, he found that that's a way to break down the monotony, but also that was a very ritualized way in which that happened. And just a bit about Donald, from what I remember, I think he actually had many, many jobs throughout, I don't know, before his academic career or when he was already an academic, but he worked a lot in kind of blue-collar positions in all kinds of factories and, you know, all kinds of contexts. So I think he's a real, you know, working sociology of work in a way.
Right, and it is very much reflected in his writing style, which was very unacademic, especially that this is written in 1959, and if you look at studies from that almost immediate post-World War II era, they usually seem to be quite inspired by the, you know, classical works with the reasonably convoluted way of presenting things. But this one reads fantastic. You have humor, you have turns of phrase, it's very lyrical, and personally kind of reminded me of Paul Auster's writing style, in, you know, occasionally, in any case.
That's funny that you say that, because one of the, like, notes that I made is actually I really feel that this text is very scientific in a way, almost like representative of modern science. You know, like this idea that you go into the field, well, at least this kind of modern science that I stand for, which is more like fieldwork based, you know, that you go, you look into the phenomena and you try to capture what is, you know, the order behind it in a way. You are really doing like empirical work, you know, so so I'll be curious to see, like, why you think that's not very, you know, scientific.
Oh no, I didn't say it's not very scientific. I mean, I referred to the presentation rather than the structure, and I'm just trying to find. There are these turns of, I mean, I found that I kind of try to write this way, that you can see that he's sneaking in, kind of smuggling in these attitudes, oh. And he's trying to convey humor and absurdity of situations. And let me just see if I can find an example.
Well, one example is where he likens the interruptions to a cuckoo clock.
For instance, yes.
You wouldn't normally expect in scientific writing. And he talks about it's a special kind of cuckoo clock, and he gives an example, which we can talk about that. But that's one example that occurs to me.
What about like the part where he talks about fatigue? So he gets a stool or a chair to rest, and some of the bosses comes down and says, this is not how we do the job, something like that.
Yes. That's a good example of him being very concrete about the kinds of things he was dealing with, I thought that was interesting because he said his legs ached after the first few days from standing up all day at the machine.
Well, I guess here, for instance, is one example of how this is both very explicitly descriptive in the best scientific way, but also well written. So one man who may or may not have been of managerial status was seen on various occasions lurking around in a manner which excited suspicion. Although no observable consequences accrued from the peculiar visitations of this silent fellow, it was assumed that he was some sort of efficiency expert, and he was referred to as the snooper. I mean, come on, how great is that? It reads like a novel.
Yeah, it's very...
Yeah, that's pretty clever.
It's very literary, yeah. That's true.
So that was something that I enjoyed thoroughly through this paper, even though it got, let's face it, a bit boring when he went on to describe every single activity and every single job process. And it's an interesting work like that. Its significance is enormous for management theory. But when you read it, it's literally a guy describing exactly what happened with these other three people that he worked with during this period of time.
When I read it, I instantly thought of so many previous texts that we discussed here, you know, from Taylor to the Human Relations School, Mayo, Maslow, but he doesn't engage so much with that. It's almost like he has like this beautiful crafted narrative, these vignettes and everything, but then it's missing, okay, and what about everyone that came before you? So it's almost like a classic missing on the classics. If you will.
That's true. He only makes a few references. There's one to Henri de Man, and then there's one to Dewey, and a couple to himself. But yeah, it's very self-contained in this way.
So maybe could we try puzzling out what are the connections with other literature?
Well, one of the things that immediately comes forth is his support for Hawthorne studies, which is Elton Mayo, that we covered in episode 9. And without referring to Mayo, he says that through these experiences, it is clear that interpersonal communications and group dynamics are important to helping people and groups of people to be motivated, to coordinate, to do work in situations where it would be cognitively challenging to persist for any long period of time.
So what about Taylorism, how do you see that?
Can I just say something about human relations before?
Okay.
No, because I think the whole Hawthorne things happened like what, 20s, 30s, and now we are in the 60s and 50s here. And I think that's interesting is that, you know, I see new topics because, you know, the Hawthorns were over like the discovery of the group element and the social element. And here, I think he's putting more meat into this idea that is showing that there is, as I said before, a specific order in which things happen, that it can be very much easily, you know, deconstructed or upset, and things, you know, don't happen as the way people were expecting them, on how much there is almost like a status and power thing going on into the whole group. So it's not like this fuzzy, warm relations, necessarily.
That is true, yes. There's this one character in their work group, I think, called George. So the description goes that they're doing their thing, they're trotting along their days, playing games and whatnot. And then this incident happens where George gets very upset by one of the things that the author and his colleagues say. And then he retreats from the group interaction. And this section of the paper is called the Black Friday. So basically it paints a picture of this utter desolation of you know, the social relations between people. And all because, as Roy later admits himself, because George withdrew and he was the sort of the focal point of all the interaction that happened within this little enclave of the organization.
Yeah, and I would just add that also, like, in the way that the themes or the jokes would happen, you know, who would share food with whom, there was almost like a specific organization of roles, you know, who was the goat of certain jokes, you know, so that show all kind of status that are being played out.
That's true, and he even mentions that the status was reflected in terms of different pay, marginally different, but still, as well as longer working hours, which was weird, because if I got it right, then the person of the higher status actually worked considerably longer than people of the, you know, lower status. So that was a bit unusual, I think.
Yes.
Well, he was making more money as a result, right? If they were being paid by the hour, it's not clear exactly how they're being paid, but it's presumably just being paid being paid by the hour. So if he gets to work an hour extra, then he's making more money than everybody else. So I think that's why that's important.
I guess you're right. He gets to work longer rather than he has to.
So I was wondering how you feel that this text fits in with Taylor. Because clearly the setting is the same, but I had the feeling that the central focus of the discussion is completely different, because we're talking about issues of monotony and of fatigue, of getting tired of this repetition. So in that sense, I felt a strong distance. I was curious to know what other people wanted to say about this.
I thought Moran had a really good observation. So a couple angles on Taylorism. One is the remark that Dimitris reported earlier about how the person lurking about was thought to be an efficiency expert. You can see, though, that there's this distrust amongst the workers about or towards efficiency experts or these people coming to snoop about at their work. So Taylor's view was it was all about the work and just the manual activities and the scientific study of the work. And yet this writing is about the motivation and the social aspects of the work, which is a completely different side of the work than Taylor even considered. And you remember that in the early days of Taylorism, a lot of workers objected to what he was doing, and they would do soldiering and, you know, deliberately slow down the job and stuff. And so this focuses more on that, the worker side of it, and that the resistance and what motivates them or how they find meaning in the work. So I thought that was interesting.
And can I add something to what you were mentioning, Ralph? If I'm not wrong, the author also says that in this organization, there is no ill will towards management. I can't remember where I saw this. Like, while Taylor has a lot of contrast, or that there's a general assumption that management works in one way, and like employees, the workers may work in another direction. Here, there isn't any contrast of that sense, but at the same time, I don't have a sense of wonderful relationships with the superintendent.
Yeah, they're puzzled by the absence of this class conflict almost, because of where they are. When he describes, I think this will be a bit of a segue, but I guess it's appropriate. When he describes their working situation, when I read, I had this eerie feeling of this dystopian almost setting, that they're in this room that is separated from the rest of the organization, and they never interact, bar occasions, with anyone else who works there, including management. They get their orders for work through a PA system. So it's just these four or five or six or however many there were people in this isolated space that is completely detached from pretty much the rest of the world for all they care. He was mentioning that if it's hot and they open the door leads to an abandoned space where there's no one. So it's this life on Mars, if you will, type of thing going on where they are actually stuck in this kind of like the 12 Angry Men, I suppose.
Well, I was thinking of the movie Brazil. That's what it makes me think of. Where people are toiling away in obscurity and dark rooms and nobody really talks to each other or at least these dismal conditions he refers to.
I never saw that movie. Maybe I should.
Well, you should.
Definitely.
So basically, they're stuck in this place. So they have no connection with the labor system that they're expecting to have, with the managers whom they never see, with the what else is there really, the superintendents, the efficiency experts. I think he even mentioned that they never see the foreman.
No, or even a union representative almost never comes by.
So there's so much here, oh my god. But I want to go back a bit to what we started talking on Taylor. Because when I read it, what I felt was that it really challenges Taylor to the ground in a way that...
Yes.
So the problem here is not that, as we said before, works do not want to work. And also the whole problem of soldiering and everything is that they need to find themselves something more to keep them, you know, focused and, well, motivated, but the main idea is to keep them focused.
Well, yeah. Right, so I would say not just focus, Pedro, but
yes,
meaning, to find
exactly
the meaning in the
and
work.
And if I remember Taylor correctly, but I must have, no, I could have forgotten because it has been for a while since we debated that. I think Taylor just assumes that people want more pay. You know, that's the whole idea. If you are going to, you know, sell the thing that you're
yes
going to pay them better, whatever, whatever, they're going to be happy. But actually, this text shows that, well, it's not enough. It's not necessarily like the money. The person is in a condition like that will still be bored. So you need to find something else. And the interesting thing here is that the workers themselves found it, you know. You could even say that a good tailor here would have thought about these kind of distractions and funds and things that would keep the worker engaged and, you know, motivated and finding the meaning that they need in the task. But Taylor never considered that.
Well, it's right. I think the Taylor's deal was that he wanted to, rather than increase pay, it was more about not wasting effort and resources. So kind of that was his thing, that employees should be motivated by the sheer virtue of that they're not wasting their time and, you know, they're being remunerated appropriately for, you know, doing the thing in the most efficient way. That was supposed to be good enough. But this is what happens when Taylor turns around and leaves the factory. This is the real deal, as we've mentioned.
Yeah, how work really happens.
Yeah, and it was an interesting bit where they outlined how during this monotonous work, they would adjust their bodily movements ever so slightly to introduce a degree of variety and initiative into the work. So you have this presumably Tayloristic or Taylor-esque system in place, but the employees are striving for initiative because by doing this one best way, they're actually not doing the best way that they could be doing the work in DC. Because it's just, you know, it's killing them with monotony.
Right. If they feel like they have to vary it. Which is very anti-Taylorism.
They want to vary. They want to introduce something of
right
their own. Yes. So that's an interesting, I guess, dichotomy to keep in mind when talking about these systems with top-down efficiency instructions. That if you, you know, we did a study and this is the most optimal way of doing this process. So let's adopt that as best practice. But you know, the ingrained characteristics of human nature, or at least, is to learn and improve and improvise, maybe, you know, not just for the sake of fun, but for the sake of, as you said, Ralph, having any meaning to being there in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Which I think connects directly to Maslow and these kind of hierarchies of needs and the need for self-actualization in the
yes
work that you do.
Very true.
So the other thing I thought was interesting, and I know that maybe we're we're skipping around too much, but I thought it was very interesting that the monotony was bad enough, but then Roy writes about the fact that monotony was joined by his twin brother. So this is part of these turn of a phrase Demetrius was talking about earlier. Fatigue is the twin brother of monotony. And I think it's particularly interesting that the workers, or at least Roy noted that when the work was more stimulating, or he understood the themes of the horseplay and creativity that the workers were able to find for themselves, that fatigue was no longer an issue, or he didn't think about it anymore. And I thought that was really interesting. It goes beyond just, you know, the monotony or the, you know, the meeting. And he didn't even feel fatigued when he was experiencing these, you know, periods of mental stimulation.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's a very good point. And I don't want to drag everything back, you know, to Taylor and time and motion studies, but that's another aspect to consider, because, you know, greatly the whole idea of time and motion studies also, in part, you were also thinking about worker welfare, you know, like the best shovel, the best condition, don't have to bend your work, like your body too much, what is also the optimum in a way that would not compromise, at least what came out of that in the whole studies of ergonomy and everything, that won't compromise the body so much. But again, they're also looking at the body almost like this, like, thing and an object.
Well, and it's a machine, right?
It's a machine, exactly. You know. Yeah, pretty much. But then we learned that actually there is almost like this different dimension that interferes with the very, you know, physical experience, which is exactly the engagement that you feel with your task.
Yeah, talk about mind over body, right?
True.
This is actually one of the themes of the paper. The whole, you know, it's self-titled Banana Time after one of the events that they would experience during working time. And I remember we were talking before the episode with you, Pedro, and you kind of referred to this as a labor process theory. And I only understood it as a paper on temporality, which is how I used it in my work on time and such things.
I'm curious.
So that was, yeah, I'm happy to go into that, certainly. It's just going to take a while.
Okay.
So.
No, I was just going to say that. So Roy is actually known for labor process theory, but I don't think that this paper specifically talks about that as much. I think his other work does. You know, when I read the paper, I was like, oh, maybe this doesn't really fit in labor process theory, but I just want to put that there in the open.
So I was wondering, maybe it's a minor point, but I felt that it was quite interesting. Did you notice a bit about the different cultural backgrounds that the people, the workers have? Because we're talking about, okay, so we're in the US in the late 50s.
Yeah, kind of.
More or less.
Yeah. Yes.
So after the Second World War, we've got two people of Jewish origin, probably from more or less the same area in Europe. Different stories, different backgrounds, different tragedies, probably. Then we've got someone from Southeastern Europe, which, what could that
Romania,
mean?
Romania, Ukraine, maybe.
Greece, Romania, okay. Yeah, I was thinking more Greece, but maybe that's too south. So another area of Europe. It's curious how I identify Europe differently, but okay. And then we also have an Arabian emigre called Boo. Two ladies that I don't think are described that
much.
Something
with an M and the
other is baby. So what I'm saying, baby and one is Mabel. So another story, other difficulties, so on. So what I wanted to say is that I find it incredibly interesting how there is so much discussion on how to reduce conflict within teams, especially conflict due to different mindsets, different cultural backgrounds, all these kind of things. But we already have this work that kind of points towards other elements that everyone has in common and that everyone has as a common background. So this idea of games and of fun is something that goes beyond multiculturality.
Yeah, it spans the cultural backgrounds. Yes. That's a good observation.
I didn't think about the whole, you know, orange or identity of the people, social identity of them. But I was reasoning a bit on what I think Dimitris and Ralph were saying about, you know, the specific, you know, like room in which they're all in and everything. And thinking in light of the things we discussed before about spirit decor, you know, that I think Fayol talks about. And we have been discussing that, you know, how does you make the workers feel something, you know, in common and go from a group to a team, and this whole thing of belonging that we also discussed in the episode on the submarine about organizational culture. And once more, I think here is a good example of how this feeling of sharedness or just spirit de corps emerges, not out of, you know, as Miranda was pointing out, not because they are, you know, from the same identity or go to the same church or anything like that. It's just because they are, the work is designed in a way that they're put together. And now it seems unsurprising, but you think about of the whole movement today to, you know, open plan offices and all these kind of things that bring proximity between people, kind of reflect that if you want.
That's actually very insightful, and you made me realize something that when we talked about esprit de corps, we were, I think, mainly talking mm-hmm. about how organization as a body united over some goal or principle or, you know, that kind of thing. But here it is an actual esprit de corps. It's the actual spirit of the body that is causing this emergent form of, you know, collaboration, that they all do the same thing and they are from different backgrounds. As Miranda mentioned, they don't really speak English well, with the exception of Roy. But through the body, mm-hmm. through the embodiment of their being there, they form this bond that, you know, they're together in this small room, they're isolated. They the games they play, they're mainly very physical, mm-hmm. you know, they're not standing there and talking philosophy. They're pranking each other, you know, in a very direct way. They're, you know, someone was smacking someone else with a newspaper on the head as a joke. You know, it's this very visceral, very immediate kind of connection. Yeah, very physical. So, and then you mentioned the open plan offices, and I was just thinking, but, you know, one of the things in open plan offices, you can see what everyone else is doing. That's kind of one of the main points of it, that, you know, transparency and whatnot, mm-hmm. but also that if you can see that everyone is doing the same thing, that my work with the architects, for instance, they had a big open plan office and everyone was just sitting by their workstations and, you know, drawing blueprints and stuff. But, you know, they're all doing that. And I think maybe just the sense of seeing that others are engaged in the same kind of very primal, very basic activity, which is either punching holes in the materials or, you know, sitting by a computer or whatever, that in itself mm-hmm. forms some form of, you know, organizational cohesion.
Well, and the other aspect of that is it's internally generated by the group, right? It's people, I mean, Fayol writes about esprit de corps as if it's a management task to generate that. Comes externally, and these workers generate their own esprit de corps, which I think is another interesting way to look at that.
Yeah, because Fayol wants to mold them, but these guys are forming.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I said something before, but I kind of regret now. Maybe you could spend like some time like going through what do these pranks and break like fun games, whatever, really look like, you know, like, we don't have to go through the whole list, but let's just, like, you know, talk about them. You know, what is this banana time anyway?
What happens in banana time is Ike steals the banana from Sammy's lunchbox every day. And there's a particular time of day this happens, or it's in a sequence of activities such that it's not completely random when it occurs. And so Ike will, you know, get the banana and he'll eat it. And then there'll be this interplay between Sammy and Ike about the banana. But interestingly enough, Sammy brings the banana every single day. And so you look at that and you say, okay, well, is he just have low intellect and he keeps doing this? And then you realize, no, he's supporting the continuation of the game by bringing the banana. And then there's this kind of, there's this verbal jousting or pairing back and forth that goes on, and then it goes off in these other directions, like George is a good daddy and so and so is a bad daddy, you know, those kinds of things. But it's kind of these verbal games that they play, and Roy talks about the importance of these mini interruptions are what sustain their interest through the day. That basically, you know, that's the thing that they look forward to, is these I don't want to say ritualized, but somewhat choreographed games that they play, that they regularly play, and it's a part of their workday.
So, you know what I find interesting? That before reading this text, I had never really thought about the importance of games, in the sense that I do play games, but I don't know. It's interesting the different roles or the different ways that games, like the different roles that games play in our everyday lives. So when, I don't know, in the animal world, game is a way of like learning things and being able to hunt. As children, it is still a learning process, but with other aims. I use games as a way of spending time, or even thinking that I'm still a kid, even though I'm not anymore. Games are also a way of socializing.
Yes, it's a way to have fun.
So they're a way of getting to know people, of overcoming trust barriers. They're also important in the work, in the working environment, as team building techniques.
Right.
And here we have this idea of breaking up monotony, which is something that I had never really put on the list.
Well, there are different hierarchies of that as well. So the games that these banana times and such are, they're kind of the more sophisticated type of activity that the people there did. I recall before that, they would play games, they would play with themselves, basically. They would try to alternate between types of material and colors, that, okay, I'm going to do 1,000 of brown, and then I get to do like 20 of blue. So that was also a game,
right?
Mm-hmm. Playing with the rhythm.
Yeah, and so non-social.
But above that, then you have the social games that you need right. others to.
So what I left out of the banana time description was, in fact, when Ike would grab Sammy's banana, he'd actually call out, banana time, and he would eat Sammy's banana. And I think it's interesting that Roy only analyzes at a very surface level, or describes at a very surface level. He uses, in the text, he says, the banana was one which Sammy brought for his own consumption at lunchtime. He never did get to eat his banana. And I'm not sure that's correct. I think actually Sammy brought it because he knew this was going to happen, and that he was okay with it. Otherwise, if you were going to get really sore about it, as they say in here, then you just stop bringing a banana. But Sammy did every day.
I don't think Roy was actually serious here. I think he was being a bit playful with his language.
It could be.
Maybe he was. I would be surprised if he was. But yeah, I'm just wondering that whether you've had some, because you know, working in the Navy and being deployed in a boat, ship, sorry. you basically have similar types of circumstances where a
absolutely.
Number of people are co-located in an isolated space.
Yep.
So
absolutely. Now, what we didn't see, never saw a kind of standard repetition like that at this level. But I did, you know, I did see stuff like that. So I'll give you an example. Is one of my peers, they decided they were going to tease him about his weight. He was complaining to people that he thought he was getting fat when he was on the ship. And so somebody sneaked into his stateroom every day or every couple of days and cut his belt small, and you know, cut shaved parts of his belt off. And it was driving him crazy because his belt didn't fit anymore. And it never occurred to him that they were cutting his belt off into smaller and smaller pieces. So he kept thinking he was getting fat, even though his pants fit the same way, but his belt didn't. And so there's many games like that people would play. Oh, another one that was played on me regularly, I'll try to keep it short, but basically there's an indicator in the propulsion plant, and it was like an odometer on your car. And so after a certain number of revolutions, it would go through zero. And there was a game that the enlisted men would play with me, and they would say, okay, if it goes across zero and you don't see it, you know, if you're not paying attention to it, then you have to buy everybody sodas in the control room. And I lost that game about 10 times because as an officer, you're supposed to pay attention to different stuff. But the enlisted men loved playing that game with me. But I played back because I could have easily have said, that's a dumb game. I don't want to play, or that, you know, you guys are just making that up. But because it does break up some of the monotony in the engineering spaces, because watching this gauge go round and round in circles is kind of boring. It does break up the game. And then somebody from outside the control room came in one time and said, he noticed that this guy was bringing down a large shopping bag of sodas. And he said, what? And they knew the game too. And they said, well, you know, that game's not fair. And I said, why? They said, because those of us outside the control room, we don't get to play. And I said, okay, then the next time this happens, if I lose the game again, I'll buy sodas for everyone, which is going from like 6 sodas to 15 sodas. And sure enough, I lost the next time. So yeah, we play lots of those
games. I love Rob's example, because I think it's the introduction to something that I wanted to discuss. It's one of the reasons why I like actually the text so much, is that although at first I was reading and had the feeling of, you know, oh, this is industrial work, you know, like last century, oh my God, what's going to have to say about, you know, contemporary white collar, whatever. But then you realize how much it touches upon something very basic about working and being together and the whole idea of organization and spending time together accomplishing goals. You know, that just think about coffee time that goes on in every single office, I think, in the world.
Yeah.
You know, I was going to add, you know, besides the classic banana time, but actually there are many, many things happening throughout the day. You know, someone's actually picking, I think the author for a time was actually picking up coke for all the others. They were like eating together, it's kind of weird fish, and they were like staring at the window together. It was all kind of like little activities beyond this one that, you know, sparse out throughout the day. But then again, I can think of so many like kind of settings and professions and situations that is so present, you know?
Yes, it does come up all the time. And one of the things, of course, I felt put upon the first few times this happened to me, but then I realized it was a game. And in fact, the people in the control room, they would deliberately try to distract me so I would lose the game. And so I realized that actually losing the game, it really wasn't about winning or losing the game. It was about participating and letting them see I would play, even though I lost so many times. And so I started to recognize that was a way for me to be closer to them and form a emotional bond with them. So the games they had, it was amazing, the diversity of the games. They had coffee time, peach time, banana time, fish time, coke time. And then, of course, there was and these were in addition to the lunchtime. And then these sort of playful interactions were also superimposed with verbal jousting and teasing back and forth that went on. I've seen that many times in the Navy and in work groups, this sort of thematically organized teasing of people. And in fact, I want to mention one other game. If you find out somebody has a particular sensitivity to the game, some people don't quite get the game aspect of it. So you can see here, Sammy was playing along with the game, but I've seen people who don't quite get it. So people would actually deliberately seek that person out to mess with them and hide books from them and those kinds of things. And they would get, you know, they would get frustrated and upset because they didn't really have that ability to kind of play with the other people in that give and take. They would take it personally when people play games like that. So that Roy doesn't describe that. But I have seen that occur in offices, and it is difficult.
That is interesting. So, like, we are getting to the more dark side aspect that I didn't consider, but now that you said that, I think if you allow me, like, the military is perhaps like exemplary of that, or, you know, like when sometimes the game is too much in a way, you know, when sometimes, especially like typical, I think in many organizations, military, but also like universities for a long time and fraternities, for instance, you know. They have this idea, you know, the newcomers have to go through something very specific, you know. And, you know, sometimes it's fun, sometimes that, like, we can justify for the social bounty, but we also know that some organizations have times, you know, do things that kind of come up as almost like violent and disrespectful, if you will. Like, not the case that, you know, Roy is describing here, because it seems very, you know, fun and about food and everything. But, you know, the game can go wrong in a way as well. And I think it can also be used, and you have a great example there, Ralph, which is, you know, someone was not in the room and they were not in that thing, so they were missing out on the bounding. And I'm sure that in the same way that games and playfulness at work can create socialization, but can also create the outgroups, you know, who is in, who is out. So it's something that Roy doesn't talk so much, but there is multiple aspects of this dimension, I think.
Well, there is an implicit mention.
Well, I was going to say, so what Pedro's talking about, really, there's an example of that here in the paper when he talks about Black Friday and the disintegration of the group. Because... Yeah. Roy decided he was going to introduce this element into the teasing, or, you know, an additional aspect of teasing that was a very sensitive chord. So you could make the argument he didn't understand the game well enough or the social interactions well enough. So he basically did what we call in the Navy, which is taking the pin out of a hand grenade and holding it up to his head. Okay, so that's essentially what he did, and it was interesting that basically the games, I mean, I think what shows is that there's some very subtle, sophisticated boundaries the games had. And if you don't respect those boundaries or those unwritten rules, you can cause chaos to occur.
I'm thinking about what you said, and it's very reminiscent of, you know, knowing the particular ways how to play a game. It's reminiscent of the literature and communities of practice and such, that it's become a bit diluted now, and that's a discussion for a different time. But basically, in order to be a part of something, you need to be very aware on a very almost instinctual level of how to conduct yourself with other people in a particular situation, when it's going too far or not far enough, or you know. And I was thinking about, in the previous episode from the conference, we were talking about this, about that when you arrive as an outsider to a group of people who know each other, then it's extremely awkward and quite stressful finding your way into, on the inside, as it were, because you don't know these things. You don't know what is appropriate to talk about, what isn't, or how to not come off as someone who people wouldn't want to talk to, or and such. So that is something that kind of surfaced when you said this story. And in terms of what Roy does, I mean, sure, he completely made a mess out of that situation, just broke it for a few weeks. He did recover, but such is that system. It's quite high reliability, I suppose, in a way. But one of the things that is achieved through having these groups of people who play jokes and people whom jokes are played on, or any variation of that, is that it creates a dynamic in the socials. I don't want to say social system. Basically, it creates a dynamic in a social setting. So here, for instance, because they were so isolated and they didn't have any management to rally against, they didn't have... other groups, they were essentially highly isolated, and he mentioned because of that, they appeared quite stagnant as a social setting, because, you know, if there is no obstacle, there is no way. So, you know, the obstacle is the way in many ways, that you need some agitation to introduce dynamic to the setting. Are you following me thus far?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so that was then, and granted, it's, I suppose, a relatively unusual setting where they were. But thinking of how work is now, that we have technology that allows people to not be together in the same place. I mean, look at us.
Right. So, textbook case.
Yeah, yeah. So you have individuals who are on their own or in small temporary groups doing work together with other people who they may not even see for the entire duration of work, when it comes to projects and knowledge work, consulting, even my work in architecture displayed these elements. And the isolation rings a bell, you know? It's you can sit with your laptop in your house working with hundreds of people all over the world and never see them, you know, outside of a Skype or a FaceTime window. And the isolation is very real. Like, think of even doing a PhD. I know it's not the most relevant or relatable example, but you're pretty much by yourself, you know, and the anxiety and the loneliness is well documented and various.
Yep. Well, and so it does apply. It does apply to PhDs, not only in the training aspect, right? When you're writing your dissertation or thesis and you're on your own for large periods of time and you don't have that interaction with your classmates if you're not at a major university. And that's why a lot of, you know, the completion rate tends to be very low, because some people can't handle that isolation. And then also sometimes working on papers tends to be very solitary. In fact, one of the things that's stressed in the United States in the George Washington program I was in is not to get discouraged by, you know, the rejections that you would get from editors you may never meet and reviewers you're never going to know about, and how to process that and keep working.
It's interesting how much, you know, there is almost a parallel between this idea of isolation of this industrial setting and one of the most, I would say, intellectual forms of work, which is a PhD. But I was just going to stress that it also is very relatable to this general idea that Dimitris was saying of just telework, in which you have people working anywhere from cafes and all, even people that belong to a bigger organization, but, you know, they're always like doing projects all across the place. So they always have to, in a way, connect people that are far away from where they are, and how, you know, stressful that may be. But then the issue there that exactly is that because since they do not have someone to share the same thing they are not in the same room with people doing the same activity. That what is, you know, like the issue, because otherwise they would have all these kind of games and banters and sharedness that we spoke before.
Right. I mean, I can give you a personal example that when I retired from the Navy, I worked with a contractor and the people I worked with, nobody was local to me that I got to work with. It was all done on telephone and participate in teleconferences. And my morale dropped considerably because I was disconnected from people. And then I had to go to my boss and say, I need a change, or I need to do something different. And so he said, well, yeah, because you don't have anybody to work with on a face-to-face or interact with, you know, periodically. So we had to restructure my work because I really wasn't enjoying it very much.
Maybe that's why people go to cafes at the end of the day, to work alone together.
Maybe so.
And that's all for part one of episode 13. Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying the discussion thus far, and next week we continue with much of these same themes, as well as go into depth on temporality aspect of this paper. Also, we're going to put out a full-length recording next week, which you'll be able to find on the episode page on our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com, and we'll generally try to do that whenever our editing process permits. In any case, we'll always let you know. Meanwhile, if you're enjoying this podcast, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes or wherever you might be listening, as these help new people find us, and share the podcast with your friends, colleagues, and students. Also, get in touch with us with any comments and suggestions, or just to say hi. We're always very excited to hear from our listeners. We hope to see you next week as we finish Roy's Banana Time here on Talking About Organizations.